helping the author, the great guy. He spent time in Cody with us. And, well, that's fascinating. Well, it's nice to see you. What a pleasure. He's a wonderful guy. So his father is
a fun experience.
Wrote the biography. I guess that's
how you know Mike's on.
Is everybody ready?
It's just wonderful.
All right, smart
there we go. Hello, everyone. Thanks for coming. We're out here this week with the Aspen Institute, as you know. My name's Carl Cannon, and I'm going to moderate. I cover the White House for National Journal, and if you're not familiar with that magazine, it's nonpartisanship approaches a fetish, sexual fetish status. We charge $1,500 a year for our magazine, so we actually have to do that. So that's where, and I'm not going to tell you a lot about myself because we've got an illustrious panel and a lot of them, and so I'm going to try to get started. The format that I'm going to do, and about half of the panelists know this and the others don't, so I hope that it's all right with them, is I'm going to introduce all of them now, and then, no, I'm not. I'm going to introduce them as I ask them a question. I'm going to ask them to speak. Bob Schieffer, Sally Quinn, Mickey Edwards, Arianna Huffington, Al Simpson, Stephen Carter. All right, they've been introduced. but I'm going to tell you a little more about them, but I'm going to actually ask them all a question. And to get the conversation started, I'm not going to be rude about it, but I'm going to ask them to speak between 4 and 5 minutes. They can answer my question or ignore it. They can pretend they're a president and just say whatever they want on this subject of civility in politics. And then what I'm going to do, if you've been going to some of these other Aspen Institute things, you know the moderator then asks a series of questions. I'm probably not going to do that. What I'm going to do is, the lights are tough, but I'm probably then going to ask questions of you and get it started. And the reason I say that is I've noticed that the questions from the audience have been better than the questions from the moderator. And I wish to not embarrass myself. So if I do this right, they'll spend about half the time on their non-prepared statements, and that'll leave half the time for questions. My first question is for Stephen Carter, the gentleman at my right, and he is a Yale law professor. He clerked for Thurgood Marshall. He's a very well-known author, but I don't know if any of you that we're in Colorado are country music fans, but the country music song that I'm thinking of is I was country before it was cool. And Stephen Carter was into civility before it was cool. And he wrote a book about it called Civility 8 years ago. And I guess my question for you, Stephen, is, okay, so you wrote the book 8 years ago. You've got at least 6 disciples, but we haven't seemingly made much progress. What more could you do, and what more should we be doing to increase the civility in American politics?
That's a very depressing question. When I wrote my book on civility, my kids were in grade school, and now they're in college. So it's the funny thing is, when I wrote the book on civility, and even now, people tended to ask me two questions. One was, what did I mean by civility? And the second was, whose fault is it that we don't have much of it? The second question, of course, is an index to the first. That is, one of the great problems in America today is we are so excited about finding who's to blame. If we can just figure out whose fault something is, we feel as though we've made progress. But very often finding out whose fault something is, we've only made things worse, because now we've set up a blame and counter-blame game, and we still have the original problem percolating around and heavily unsolved, as I like to tell my first-year law students. When I think of civility, I should explain, and this is what I said in the book as well, I'm not referring to manners and etiquette, although as it happens, I do believe in manners and etiquette, but I'm talking instead about the sacrifices that we as citizens of a great democracy ought to be making for the sake of living a common life. That is to say, what are the small ways in which we should restrain our impulses and the large ways in which we should be charitable toward others, especially others with whom we have sharp disagreements, in order to live a common life? And what I want to use my 3 remaining minutes on is one quick example to try to explain what I mean. I was a law clerk for Thurgood Marshall, and the last year of his life, I spent a lot of time with him because I was the interviewer for his oral history project, so we spent many, many hours together. What's striking about those many hours that we spent together was that I never heard him say an ill word about another human being, including, I should say, justices of the Supreme Court after his retirement, who were busily tearing down the structure that he had worked to build. His view was to always try to reach out and find the good in other people. Best example is this. In 1954, when Brown versus Board of Education was decided, letting your cell phone ring is a good example of incivility when other people are trying to listen. In 1954, when Brown versus Board of Education was decided, when Thurgood Marshall was arguing as the principal lawyer on behalf of the NAACP, the states that wanted to segregate went out and found the man who was then considered the best lawyer in America, a Southern gentleman, a West Virginia gentleman, I should say, named John W. Davis, to argue their case. Davis was a partner in a New York law firm. He had argued more than 400 cases before the Supreme Court. And he also was a segregationist. He genuinely believed in segregation. So when I was clerking for Thurgood Marshall, I was 25 years old and therefore, by definition, knew pretty much everything there was to know. I said to him, because he liked to tell stories, I said, tell me about John W. Davis. And I assumed that he would do what I would have done, which is to call down hellfire and damnation upon his head. He didn't do that. He said, John W. Davis, he said, a good man, a great man, who just happened to believe in segregation. Now, when he said that, I want to emphasize he was not being facetious, nor was he making light or making a joke. It was a part of his life's work to genuinely build bridges to people with whom he had sharp disagreements, including on the greatest moral divide, I would argue, in America on the 20th century. And part of the untold story of Marshall's work is the amount of time he spent negotiating in back rooms with some of the worst segregationists of the era to make a deal. He didn't care what their politics were. He didn't care what speeches they gave. He cared about whether their word was good and if you could do business with them. He didn't care about the rest of it. To him, they were still people to work with. And that critical notion to reach out and find the humanity in those with whom we disagree and to therefore treat them as deserving respect, notwithstanding the depth of our disagreement, I think is crucial to trying to recover that sense of shared sacrifice that I mean by civility.
I think Stephen's answer has led naturally to me to introduce Alan Simpson now, not just because he's the next guy in the line, but because Alan Simpson was a senator from Wyoming for many years. He was our favorite as a reporter. He always returned calls, and after he got done cussing you out, he'd give you a good quote. And he wrote a pretty good book at kicking us in the fanny, us being the media. But and Senator Simpson, since he left the Senate, has gone to Harvard. He was head of the IOP, the Institute of Politics there. He's left that job. He was such a fixture in Wyoming politics that there was one rule Dick Cheney told me he had when they would campaign together, and he would say, I would never follow Alan Simpson. Somebody here is going to have to follow Alan Simpson tonight. But the reason I thought of him was because the senator went back to Washington recently, and he didn't really like what he saw. He didn't find that people were finding the common ground that Stephen Carter talked about. In fact, he said that people, the motto there was, don't get mad, get even. And it used to be, let's figure out what we can get for our side. He called the politicians of Washington today seethers. And Senator Simpson also predicted this would happen during the Bob Bork hearings. And he was at that time dismayed at the Democrats' rhetoric. He now seems to be, I don't want to put too many words in his mouth, but a little bit upset with his own party, the Republican Party. So, Senator, does Washington
he
work
didn't
anymore?
Tell me about this. No, go ahead. What is? Oh, that was the question.
You're it.
Well, it's confession time. I'm sitting next to the person I suppose I expressed the last bit of incivility on a program one night. I think it was Larry King, wasn't it? I'm on satellite, and you can't see anything. It's just the camera, so you don't get to see who's there, which is a bad way to do it because I get to see all you people. Anyway, Ariana was on there, and I was smoking away, and I said, I'll tell you, Ariana, I remember when you were a Republican, had the finger out there. And she said, I can't believe what you're doing. I said, well, I'm doing it. Anyway, so now with that confession out of the way, because that was the last vestige of total incivility.
You're completely forgiven.
God bless you, my dear. But anyway, she's a strong, you see things in other people that you see in yourself, but you don't deal with it yourself. and then you lash out. It's a trait. You say, Jerry Spence, the lawyer, I said, came home one night, we were trying a case on the same side. I said, you know, Spence is slick and witty and oleaginous and scratching the juries up and buttering them. I said, just makes me sick. And Ann said, you mean like you do? So you got to watch those things. But I always thought and think that politics is a contact sport. Now, it is. And you're entitled to be called a fool, boob, idiot, squirrel, bonehead, slob. All that is fair, but never let them distort who you are. And when they distort who you are, let me tell you, I really come out of the woodwork. Because an attack unanswered is an attack believed. In fact, furthermore, and who was the great Democrat consultant, died, Squire?
Yeah, Bob Squire.
Bob said, no, Al, an attack unanswered is an attack agreed to. So you have that mechanism on always in your craw. That does not lead always to civility. And the part that's about that is so confusing, the people who are telling you not to respond are the people who love you the most. Your mother, your father, your wife, your brother, they're saying you're not going to get down on their level. No one is going to believe what they've said about you. And I'll say, I am going to get down. it's not a good thing. But I'll say this, some of my best pals in the Senate were Democrats. Ted Kennedy is a very close personal friend. I do not judge people. I'm not. There's somebody way up there that does that work. And so they'll say, oh, God, you like Kennedy. And he'd walk down the street with me in Boston. They'd say, what the hell are you doing with Simpson, you know? So it's the same thing. It's a stereotype. A lot of that goes on here. It seems to go on, and people think it doesn't go on. I thought today of Hollywood. If Hollywood really knew a conservative Republican, there would be a different attitude. And if a conservative Republican really knew the people of Hollywood, it would be a different attitude. But they don't. And that's too bad. And that's the kind of stuff you have to break down. But that's about civility. But it's not just civility in Congress. Don't worry about that. Start at the city hall, county commissioner's race, school board. That's where it is. It's a representative government. It didn't start up there. It started down there.
Well, that leads me to Sally Quinn. Sally is, I've known her all my adult life, and if you grew up in journalism like I did, she was a legend at the Washington Post, and she helped make a whole form of journalism, the style section. Before that, they were the women's section, and Sally was one of a pioneering group of women writers. They convinced some editor, I forget his name, Sally, but he was at the Post, to let them really do journalism and get out there. And Sally gave as good as she got. She wrote stories. They were tough stories. Well, I'm going to garble this, and I want you to correct me, but what was her name, Maxine? What was her
Cheshire.
Name? Maxine Cheshire and her would go out and do these profiles of people, and I'm probably going to get this backwards, but the quip in Washington was when Maxine writes about you want to kill her, but when Sally writes about you want to kill yourself. So do I have that backwards? Close enough? Close enough. Might have been the other way around. In any event, Sally would be a tough journalist. But she's also a Washington person who cares about government. She's a hostess. Sally, here's my question to you. In Washington today, can people do what Senator Simpson talked about? Can they beat the crud out of each other verbally and then go out and have a drink and be friends?
They could.
Do they?
No, and it's too bad. When I first came to Washington, it was in the late 50s, and I had no political persuasion. My father was in the military and was very strong conservative, and his best friend was Barry Goldwater, and actually he got me a job working for Barry in the Senate one summer. And so I spent a lot of time with Goldwater. I went off to Smith College, which my father was horrified because he said it was too pinko. And he was right. When I came back after my first semester, I was a raging liberal. And I used to have these terrible fights with my father and with Barry. But there was one thing that was always very clear to me and has always been clear to me the whole time I've lived in Washington and all the people I've known, whether they're Republicans or Democrats, the people I've been close to, My father and Barry, I think, were the two greatest patriots that I've ever known. My father fought in two wars. He really loved this country, and so did Barry. And there was never any question in my mind about that. And I loved my country, too. And what it became clear to me was that they had a different view of how things should be done, but their goal was the same, which was what was best for the country. And when Ben and I first got together, I introduced Ben and Barry, and they were a little suspicious of each other. They got to be best friends. And as it turned out, I mean, in fact, they once spoke together in Orange County, and all these right-wing conservatives were just really waiting for blood. And Barry got up and said, "I'm really sorry to disappoint you, but Ben Bradley's a great guy," which he hadn't known before. And you all probably know that Barry Goldwater was very close to Jack Kennedy. And in fact, when they were going to run against each other before Kennedy was assassinated, they were going to fly around on the same plane together and campaign together with different points of view. And one of the things that was really interesting when Ben and Barry got to be friends is that during the last days of Watergate, when Barry was going to the White House almost every day to try to persuade Nixon to resign, he would come back and we would go over to my parents and Barry would tell Ben what happened, and Ben would then get it printed in the Washington Post. And no one would ever have known that. In fact, I don't think anybody's ever said that before, that that's where the Post was getting all their great stories, is from Barry Goldwater. But if you had to ask me what I think the most important thing, I mean, I think that this clearly things have gone in a really horrible direction. And I think that there are several reasons, but I think the most important reason is that people don't eat together. And if people sat down and ate together and had a drink together, they would learn about each other and they would find out that there are not that many differences, particularly people who care about the country the way so many people in Washington do. You learn that, you know, you have a child who's sick. You both have had a sick child, or a parent who has just died, or some family problem that brings you closer to that person and makes you realize that person is just another human being the way you are. And I think that's one of the real problems in Washington, is that people don't ever have time to get together. And you know what the villain is? The villain, and the House chaplain once told me this, is the airplane. That once people started flying back to their districts, they never had time to sit down and eat together and have drinks together. In the old days, you know, people would fight and argue on the floor of the House or the Senate or all over Washington, and then at 5:30 or 6 o'clock, they'd go out and have dinner together and they'd be friends. And now people go to their home districts, they come back Monday evening, they work until 10 o'clock every night, they leave on Thursday. No one knows anybody. Nobody knows anybody. And I really think that this is the biggest problem with Washington now, is that people actually knew each other. They could sit down and talk to each other, and you would not have this terrible rancor and this poison that is, I think, really hurting our country.
Thank you, Sally. That's going to lead me to Mickey Edwards, another former member of Congress, another Republican. Mickey's from Oklahoma. He represented 18 years, how long?
16.
16 and a half. I was just off memory, you know.
Yeah, I wanted 18, but I only got 16.
Then he's been teaching. He taught at Harvard for 11 years after that. He's been at Princeton. He's now running a program at the Aspen Institute that gets Republicans and Democrats together to avoid exactly what Sally's talking about. He's trying to get them young before they get... they get corrupted and perverted. But Mickey, I wanted to ask you, and I mentioned this to you, and please, you know, he could give a Fidel Castro-length speech on this subject. Mickey could. He's got 4 or 5 minutes. But we were at a press conference at Princeton together, and it was on polarization. And polarization, the way the political science talk about it, is the separating of the parties ideologically. But the conversation quickly turned to civility and discourse. And it became obvious to me that these are two separate but reinforcing phenomena. As the parties get further apart ideologically, the rhetoric gets tougher. As the rhetoric gets tougher, they really start to dislike each other. Mickey, is there any way to break this cycle?
Well, there probably is. But
say whatever you want. Don't go by my question.
Well, I had actually warned Carl that, you know, politicians always take whatever question is asked and, you know, they say whatever they were going to say anyway. I agree with what people have said so far. I just, and part of the problem, as Sally points out, in the Congress itself is that people don't know each other. They don't travel together. And some of it is actually the way the Congress is operated. My party, you know, Denny Hastert has said, you know, we're not going to bring anything to the House floor unless a majority of the majority is for it. I mean, it's an attitude and before that it was Jim Wright, so I'm not just picking on my party. But, you know, but there is that problem. But the problem is deeper than that. And I don't want to have it just focus on what's wrong with Washington and how people in Congress don't just talk to each other. At this conference we were at Princeton, and I was one of the hosts of that conference, there was a fascinating talk by a reporter from the Austin American Statesman, Austin, Texas, about a series of articles that he had done about how people in this country are self-selecting into communities that are like themselves. And there's a lot of talk, and it's kind of superficial, that we're not really red states and blue states. There's a lot of purple states out there. Well, there are not purple states. There are states that have some red areas and some blue areas. So when you add up the electoral votes, it may look purple. But people are tending to live with people like themselves and not interacting with people. You know, I do know people who do are very broad-minded, very open-minded, and they read a broad range of political issues. Everything from the National Review to Human Events or a Weekly Standard. Or they read everything from the New Republic to the Nation. You know, and they think that, you know, and when you all remember Pauline Kael, famous saying from Pauline Kael. Well, I don't know how Nixon won. I don't know anybody who voted for him. You know, there is a lot of that where people don't really find themselves engaging in. I was teaching at Harvard at the time of the Republican Revolution that took over the Congress. And political scientists who study this stuff and who are supposed to know the members of Congress and all that would come to me after, you know, people like Henry Hyde would become a chairman or, you know, Newt Gingrich would become speaker, and they would say, who are these people? You know, what do they want? You know, where do they come from? And, you know, and it's because there was so little willingness to understand. But there are people in here who don't know anybody who ever bought anything at Walmart. You know, I mean, and it's sort of we talk to people who think like us. You know, you don't have to identify yourself either. You know, we tend to talk to people who think the way we do. So what happens? The people who get elected to Congress come out of those communities, and it's been. Just very quickly, exacerbated by two other phenomena. One of them is, you know, because of the rise of television advertising and consultants, political consultants make their money by having you not do grassroots but be on television. You know, so the quick soundbite that's nasty because it's what works. You know, that these kinds of things, you know, play into the problem. The other one, the last one I'll mention, is redistricting. So many people are apathetic politically that they don't vote in primaries. And the way the primaries are structured now, you end up either voting for somebody who's much farther to the right of the general public or much farther to the left than the general public. And when they're in public office, you know, they're on the extremes. The American people are in the middle, you know, but the people who represent them in Washington are not. And that's another part of it. So I just wanted to make the point that it's not just getting members of Congress to get to know each other. I think the problem is deeper than that.
Well, so when Stephen Carter says we got to go down to the state and even the city level, you say even further to the individual level.
Yeah.
People need to look in their own parts.
Be open,
how they speak and how they
be open to talking to people who aren't just like you.
All right, thank you. I'm going to now introduce a woman that doesn't need to be introduced. But before I do that, Ms. Huffington. Bob Schieffer said last night at another session he did, I don't know if any of you were fortunate enough to see it, with Katie Couric, and I'll be honest with you, I mean, two TV journalists, I'm a print guy, I wouldn't have gone that, but it was raining and I was already in the tent, so I stayed. And they were wonderful, you know, they were really good. And Bob Schieffer told a story about these emails that they get, you know, and we all get them. Some of you may send them. We, you know, and he said in the old days, you know, you'd sit down at a typewriter, you have to type out the thing. That took some effort. You have to put a return address. You have to get a stamp. But mostly you wouldn't even send it because by the time you wrote the thing, you'd vent it. But now you write this thing, you
you fascist, you know, whatever. And all you have to do is push a button. It's easier than throwing it away. And so that brings me to Arianna Huffington. And I wrote her an email. It was so late, she didn't get to respond to it. But I said, Miss Huffington. And later I thought, what kind of an idiot am I? I mean, she's like a Brazilian soccer player, right? One name, Arianna. So, and why? Because she's a one-man, you know, news organization, too. She's
one woman.
One woman.
One woman.
That's what I meant.
Very good.
I even wrote one woman, Stephen. I need you to vouch for me. All right. She's a Tribune. She's a columnist for the Tribune media circulation column. She's an author of books. She has started, I'm sure many of you know, or most of you know, the Huffington Post, which I believe is the newspaper of the future. And she's in the new media. And I guess my question is for you, is the new media contributing to the incivility? Is the technology of it, and everything from emails to try and get some attention out of the 7 million blogs to call each other even ever more horrid names, is this contributing to the lack of civility in American discourse?
It is contributing it. It is not causing it, and it is fixable. Like at the Huffington Post, we have very strict rules. First of all, we have over 750 bloggers, so we choose who to give a password to. Now, if, let's say, one of our bloggers chooses to use certain words, which we don't ever front page, we have the choice who we're going to front page, who we're going to send to Yahoo News, who we're going to basically promote on our homepage. If anybody writes that Dick Cheney is a fascist, for example, it will not be ever featured, because we just don't believe in this language. You can say, as I believe, that Dick Cheney... policies have made America less safe, they have encouraged terrorism. You can be as tough as you want, but you are not going to use certain words which are completely inappropriate and which actually make your argument less effective. That's what I'm trying to tell people. The facts, if you are against Dick Cheney, sorry, Alan,
I'm listening.
are so much on your side. Why would you have to use over-the-top rhetoric to make your point and basically alienate a large percentage of people that you would want to convert? So if you're in the business of persuasion, as opposed to simply speaking to the converted, which has never interested me, since I actually myself 10 years ago left the Republican Party, having been persuaded by better arguments, I'm always interested in persuading rather than alienating by over-the-top rhetoric. So these are the kind of rules that we are applying. We also have our comments on the blog site are moderated. We have invested an enormous amount of resources so that comments do not appear if we get trolls or people who simply want to use ad hominem attacks. We feel we're hosting our bloggers, and we are hosting conservatives. We have regulars like Danielle Crittenden, who is married to David Frum, among other things, who wrote the famous Axis of Evil speech, and she writes twice a week at least. And others who are less frequent, like Tony Blankley or John Fund, you know, conservatives. And we are very careful for them to feel welcome, to feel that they are not going to be attacked. Let me just say something, that the fact that you can write anonymously on a blog as a commenter, not as a blogger, not using your name, I think encourages incivility. The closer you are to each other, the less likely you are to be incivil. I mean, the fact that Alan and I had a contretemps, which I can't exactly remember what you said, Alan, but I know that the fact that he couldn't see me, the fact that I was in another city, contributed to that. While if you're next to somebody, you're much less likely to do that, which is part of Sally's argument, that if you're eating together, you're much less likely to think that the other person is the devil. At the same time, those of you who read the Huffington Post know that I write every day, and I'm incredibly strongly against a lot of what this administration is doing. Perhaps everything this administration is doing, but the language.
Wait, what about the Hawaii refuge? You're not against
that. That's a very good thing.
Okay. See?
No, never everything. Never everything. That's another thing. Never everything. But I was taken on by the commenters on our own site, when, for example, I wrote about my encounter with Condoleezza Rice at a Time magazine dinner, and I wrote, and I thought it was a kind of satirical piece. I wrote that as I was being introduced to her, all the questions that I really wanted to ask her about the war, about Iran, blah, 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 were going through my mind. And all the answers that she was going to give me were also going through my mind. Because obviously I wasn't going to ask her anything in a social situation that she couldn't answer perfectly comfortably without batting an eyelid. So I thought I really wanted to ask her a question to which, A, I did not know the answer she was going to give, and B, to which I knew she would give me an honest answer. So I asked her, who made your dress? It was a black tie event, so she was wearing a very beautiful gown. And I thought, well, I'll get an honest answer, and I won't know what she'll say. Well, I was crucified. You were next to Condoleezza Rice, and you asked her who made her dress, blah, blah, blah. You know, they didn't get the joke. So part of incivility is humorlessness. I think you have to have a certain sense of humor,
yes,
which definitely makes it easier to be with people with whom you don't agree. One very quick thing, which is about, I think, what I think is one of the root causes of incivility, not to justify it, but to try and explain what is happening right now. Times of war bring about a very, very strong reaction, stronger than ever before. We had it during Vietnam, right now during Iraq. I mean, people feel, including myself, incredibly strongly against this war, and there are people who feel incredibly strongly for this war. And that tends to make people filled with outrage, which sometimes makes them feel unable to control themselves. Again, not to justify it,
no,
but
that's
to try
a good,
and understand
that's absolutely. I mean, when Johnson was president, long before the internet, his daughters went to sleep at night hearing the chant, LBJ, LBJ, how many kids have you killed today? So that, you're right, wartime does bring
and
that up. And thank you for bringing that
up.
Let me go to Bob here. This is a man who needs no introduction, but I'm going to do it anyway. Briefly, Bob's a reporter's reporter. That phrase is my dad's phrase. He worked with Bob at the White House. My father's a reporter too. But you don't have to take it from me or my dad. He's a member of the Broadcasters Hall of Fame. And unlike baseball players, you don't have to be retired for 5 years to get in. He covered the White House, the Pentagon.
It does mean the end is
near. He covered the White House, the Pentagon, the State Department, Capitol, all the beats. So let me ask you this way. Where do we fail, the traditional media? Where do we fail the public on this issue of civility? Because this didn't start with the blogs.
No, it didn't. And I'm not sure we failed. I mean, I think we pretty much reflect what's going on. We're kind of a mirror that we hold up, and sometimes it's not a very pretty picture. What I think, Carl, is I think the whole system is broke right now. I think the way these districts are being gerrymandered now, you know, it used to be that my little brother, used to be in the Texas legislature. At one point, he was the youngest member of the Texas legislature, and I always remember his district. In that district, the richest people in town were in one precinct, and that was in his district. The largest black precinct in Fort Worth was in his district, and the largest blue-collar precinct in Fort Worth was his district. That was the people that worked out at what is now General Dynamics. We called it the bomber plant. His voting record in the Texas legislature had to reflect all three of those constituencies, and he had to make compromises among his constituents, and that was reflected in how he voted in the legislature. Now you're getting these districts where, as Mickey is talking about, you have all the people that think one way, they're over in one district, and all the ones that think another way are over in another district. Black, white, conservative, liberal. They don't have to make the kind of compromises that they used to have to make at home. Another part is, and I think one of the main reasons for incivility, is that it costs so much money now to run for Congress that you have to sign off with so many special interest groups at home before you get elected that once you get to Congress, your positions are set in stone. Congress has lost its ability to compromise, and that's why it never does anything of a significant nature anymore. And because it can't come to any agreement on anything of significance, it fools around with these hot-button issues, which are great fundraisers for the people on both sides of the issue. And I think that, again, encourages this incivility. Sally talks about people in Washington don't know anybody anymore. It's almost the same in the home districts. The first politician I ever saw was Lyndon Johnson. I was 10 years old. We heard he was coming to the vacant lot where we played baseball on the northwest side of Fort Worth, and my dad took me down to see him. And the reason that we went is because we heard he was coming in a helicopter, and we had never seen a helicopter before. So we all went down there, and it was a big event in the community. People came. But, you know, and it was a wonderful event. He made a wonderful speech. I'll never forget. At the end, he took his hat off and threw it out into the crowd, you know, and then waved goodbye. I told this story many years later to Jake Pickle, the longtime congressman from Austin. He said, oh, yeah. He said, that was my job. I said, what? He said, I was the hat catcher. I said, what? He said, let me tell you something. Lyndon Johnson was the tightest man on earth. He wasn't going to waste a hat. He said, I would drive. I'd stand on the front row. He'd see me, throw the hat to me. I'd run around behind the helicopter, give it to him. He'd fly off to the next place. But it was a great show. And everybody in the community came down and took part in it. But the thing to remember, and the thing I remember, it was an amateur sport, politics, in those days. Now we've turned it into a professional sport. We've brought in these consultants with their computers who tell you who the people are that lived in that area, in that neighborhood where I live. There's no contact anymore. And you know, when you have professionals who are telling you how to run your campaign, telling you what the issues are, it's a lot different than when the advisors who are supporting, the people who supported Lyndon Johnson, they were all amateurs. They had other jobs. One of them may work at the hardware store. One of them may work at the bank. But the deal was, when your candidate won, that was great. You could be joyous in victory. But if your candidate lost, you had to live with the defeat, and you had to live in that community. The consultants today, now that we have made this a professional sport, they collect their money and move on to the next community, and that, what we have in the wake, is what we have today. People who don't know each other, who don't know about each other, and they come to Washington and they can't do anything.
Thank you. All right, I'd like to take some questions from the audience. I don't know if there's a mic out there or not. Yes, there is. Okay, so it's a little dark, but over here is a lady. Try to get her attention. There we go. All right, who has a question? Here's one over here. Wait for the mic, please.
Could you comment, please, about talk show hosts and their influence? Some of them are very, very popular, and they have huge followings, and I know they influence a lot of people. And they will raise an issue and not discuss the issue, but engage only in a smear campaign on the other side. And what do you think about
that? Who wants to take that?
Well, I'll tell you, I'd like to, because I'm privileged and honored to do some of that stuff, even now. They invite me back. It's a terrible thing. I enjoy Jim Lehrer, the top of the game. There are some very wonderful interviews, and Chris Matthews, and Larry King. But I'll tell you, I did Hannity and Combs once about 3 years ago, maybe four, during a campaign. I was in Indianapolis or something. They said, now we'll bring a satellite, and I'll have the affiliate. And I sat there and never said a word for 10 minutes while these two guys just laughingly hacked each other to bits and cackled. And I don't know who I'm offending, but I've done so much of that in life that it couldn't possibly affect me. But at the intermission, I said, there'll be an empty chair in the corner, and don't ever call me again. I do not intend to get on something like this, which is just blasting away. Crossfire died its own death. They buried it alive. If people are going to watch it, they'll keep it. But if they don't, the first rule of television is money and entertainment. There is no other function. It's not news. It's money, bottom line, and entertainment. And so I dropped out of that one, and there are just some it's not fun. It's just everybody all juiced up.
I just wondered if you could tell us what shows you have in mind particularly.
That was one of them, right?
Talking about the Sean Hannity's, the Glenn Beck's, the Ann Coulter's of the world, those kind of people who are
She's saying she was talking. That's the show she was talking about, Hannity and Combs, and some of the Ann Coulter.
All right. The people who engage in smear techniques, Bill O'Reilly does some of that also.
You could say that.
Rather than engaging in, not talking about the Jim Lehrer.
Yeah. So the guy who wrote the book on civility is too polite to interrupt, but I think Stephen Carter has something.
Oh, well, two small points. One is my wife was once on one of these talk shows and told the following interesting story. They were taping the show. And the host, who is a host who's known for not letting anyone get the word, my wife's a really tough woman, and she was sort of walking all over him for 5 minutes. And then they stopped and announced, oh, something wrong with the satellite. We have to retape that segment. Mm-hmm. And they taped it with her mic off for most of the time, letting the host do the talking instead. Having said that, I want to suggest to you that the talk show hosts, whether they're on the left or the right, whether they're doing smears or slogans, they're not the problem. The audience is the problem. What we're talking about is a cultural phenomenon. It's not a media phenomenon or a political phenomenon. It's a cultural phenomenon. We live in a culture in which all of us, to some extent, and I'll plead guilty too, are accustomed to casually, when we're among our friends, dismissing out of hand with very often very cruel language people with whom we have disagreements, often people we've never met. They tend to be famous people, you know, with whom we have disagreements. If they were right here, I wouldn't ask them about their what dress they had on. I'd tell them this and this and this. We have these casual conversational habits that add up to a big problem for democracy. Because I want to suggest to you that what makes democracy special is not the fact that we vote. What makes democracy special, what makes it work, is our ability to respect each other enough to entertain as well as make actual serious arguments. And if we're watching these shows or listening to them on the radio, we are expressing our preference not to make or listen to serious arguments. All that would ever change that would be a change in people's viewing habits. The entertainment companies that put these shows on, they're not doing anything serious with them. They're simply entertaining because that's the audience taste. If the audience had a different taste, they would get different shows.
There's something specific I want to say in relation to Ann Coulter, because I think the mainstream media have a responsibility here, and I'd love to know, Bob, why you think the Today Show would have Ann Coulter on. Or why Jay Leno? And I'm not asking you to. I know you didn't have her on. But the question is, what is it about people in the mainstream media who will go out and talk about the incivility and then invite her to be on their shows? Because it is their bully pulpit. She can exercise her First Amendment in her own forums. But why are they inviting her and therefore legitimizing her in some way? I mean, I, for example, had my last encounter with her a few months ago, and then after that I would never appear on a show with her. And everybody can make that choice.
I'd
it's
like
and part of it is the toxicity of what that kind of rhetoric puts out there.
All right, let's take another question here. Please wait for Mike, sir.
Did you really do that?
All directions.
There we go.
A lot of this discussion has been about the cultural issues, and a lot of what sounds like almost market forces, what the audience wants to hear, where people want to live with people like them. And I feel like I'm hearing mostly a discussion of the elements of the problem. And I'm just wondering, you mentioned the Institute's program that you're running. I'm just wondering, what can we do? If it is market forces, how are we going to intervene? How we, you know, what can any of us do in our nonprofits, in our government life, wherever?
Thank you. Sally?
Well, I have a friend, Jerry Rafshoon, I think he may be here, who has just started this organization with Hamilton Jordan. Jerry Rafshoon helped get Jimmy Carter elected. And
a man named Doug Bailey, who was a Republican consultant, right. And they've started a group called Unity 08.
Well, there's a former congressman from this state is with them. What's his name, Mickey? You know him?
Angus King.
No.
Is it Dave Scott?
Yes, Dave Scott.
Well, Dave, yeah. I mean, actually, right. Jerry should... But what they want is to have a convention on the Internet, choose a ticket that is... bipartisan. They would have a Republican and a Democrat on the ticket, and I won't go into how complicated it is, but all of the it's not that complicated, but all of the everyone can register, go on, vote for this ticket, and they will be on the ballot in November of 08. And the idea is to bring people together and to promote civility and to stop all of this this anti-partisan behavior.
If this were a presidential press conference, you wouldn't get a follow-up. But I'm going to ask one for you. Based on what Sally said, Bob or Mickey, does it take a president? It takes a village. With all due respect to Hillary Clinton, President Bush ran to say he'd be a uniter, and he has not done that for a lot of reasons. We won't go into them. But will it take a president to do some of what Sally's talking about?
Oh, I think it will. And I think there are some things that can be done. And they're radical. I mean, I think we need a radical program here. I think, number one, we ought to do what some other countries have done. And, the hardest thing, and what makes it so hard to write political regulations, and Al will agree with this, and campaign laws, is because the group that is being regulated writes the law. So it's impossible to ever make it totally objective. I think the situation on redistricting, which I think is one of the major causes of what our problem is here, in some other countries, and I think this is something that should become a part of the national discussion, they have done what we have done on base closings in this country. The way they close, it got to the point when you wanted to close military bases in this country, you simply couldn't get it done because the congressman in this district said, if you'll promise not to close my district, I'll promise not to close your district. So what they did is they created this commission. The commission holds hearings. It makes its recommendations on which bases should be closed and which bases should not be closed. And then Congress votes on it up or down. They don't vote to close one or the other.
You're talking about the nation of Iowa.
What I'm saying, this is... Yeah,
Iowa does that.
You vote it up or down. I think you could devise some sort of a commission, maybe retired federal judges or something, every 10 years after the census, let them draw the congressional districts and let the Congress vote on it up or down. I think that might be one thing we could do.
There are states already that do that, and taking it out of the hands of the state legislature.
And I
want you to add one thing
sure.
to what he was saying. Part of it is overcoming the problem that Sally was referring to. The Aspen Institute has a program that I run where we go out and bring together young political leaders of the two parties. And we're not looking for centrists. The problem is not trying to find a mushy middle. The problem is finding conservatives and liberals able to talk together, to appreciate each other, and to sit down and find a way to work together to solve a problem. And so the Aspen Institute actually is working on bringing young political leaders together to sit around the table and try to do that. So that's one way to address the problem.
Well, I would also do away with the Electoral College. I would... I would make it more proportionally. If you win a congressional district, then you get one electoral vote.
That's easy for a Texan to say. Does a Wyoming guy agree?
Let me tell you, if you get rid of the Electoral College, we'll never see another presidential candidate in the rest of history.
Well,
because they're never going to go. They're going to go to New York. They're going to go to L.A. They're going to go to every population center. They'll leave out South Dakota, Wyoming. Why waste time?
They now don't go to California.
Well, but they'll never go to the
system,
little population.
This system was designed to give the small state a voice. What we have done is we've designed a system where the large states don't have a voice. We have 13 battleground states.
How about the U.S.
deciding? We have 13 battleground states deciding who's going to be president. And the rest of the country just sits there and watches through binoculars.
Well, and this is the problem, what you've been talking about, and Mickey, too, that
the gerrymander, the gerrymander districts in the risk disenfranchising every voter in the country.
Yeah.
And that and that's one of the reasons. People, it's easy for people to be angry when they don't really have a voice.
Exactly.
I'm sorry. This is a great discussion. I could go for another hour, but two of our panelists have another thing that they have to do. And so unless someone had a burning question, I'm just going to have to say, yes, you. One more question.
Make is it burning? Is it a burning question?
It's a bit of a follow-up. I'm a Texan, and we just went through mid-decade redistricting, which the U.S. Supreme Court failed to strike down last week. And frankly, it scares me to death for the rest of the country because it's created extremism in our districts in Texas. Do any of y'all see any solution to that problem, or have the barn doors opened, or are we going to see mid-decade redistricting in other states now?
Who can answer in 1 minute?
Well, first of all, let me say that I think Bob has a very important point about how you do the redistricting. That undid, you know, what DeLay did, undid a Marty Frost redistricting. They had a Phil Burton redistricting in California. You know, the problem has been whichever party is on top tries to draw the lines, you know, to help themselves. And that's why I think Bob's suggestion about having it not done by the legislatures, you know, is a good way to solve that problem. Every 10 years, hopefully.
Anyway, thank you very, very much for coming. Thank you, panelists.
So, okay. And the Casper Star Tribune, the biggest daily they put...